The Black Avenger.
Godfrey Cambridge is Gravedigger Jones. Raymond St. John is Coffinhead Johnson.
Look out for a brother, man.
What you gonna play now?
Is the girl crazy?
I sure am hungry.
Baby, check, baby, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2.
Black is black.
And you're black.
He was as big as Muhammad Ali.
Black is beautiful.
Right on.
And I'm black, y'all. And I'm blickety black, blacker than black, black. I'm blacker than black, yo. Because I'm black, black, black.
Hello, and welcome to the first best of episode of the JB's Low Tech Podcast. I'm going to play some past interviews and hopefully entertain. And we'll do that right after this on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
When you need someone to listen. A lawyer you know and trust.
Congratulations to all the Minnesota businesses that scraped through the last year. It sure hasn't been easy, but we've done it together. And while we certainly need to move forward, it's good to reflect on what we've been through and the many losses. Here at Bradshaw & Bryant, we held a lot of Zoom meetings, increased our phone calls, and have done our best to keep up with all the changes while continuing to provide quality work. We'd like to thank everyone that turned to us with their personal injury and criminal needs, as well as the courtrooms for bringing the community back together to serve justice. We look forward to being part of Minnesota's growth and success for many years to come. I'm Mike Bryant from Bradshaw & Bryant. I hope you're never injured in a collision, but if you are, don't sign anything till you've talked to us.
Find Bradshaw & Bryant, personal injury attorneys at minnesotapersonalinjury.com.
Seeking justice for the injured, Bradshaw & Bryant.
Back, ladies and gentlemen, on the JB's Low Tech Podcast. I said I was going to do something a little bit different today, and that is I'm going to have my first interview for the podcast. I'm having my first guest is somebody who actually slept on my couch in college, but but he wanted me to refer to him as King. But his actual title is filmmaker, and he's Minnesota's own hero, Van Hayden. How you doing, Van?
Good, JB. How you doing, brother?
I'm just trying to make sense of what's going on in this world right now, man.
So, yeah, I was kind of joking about that King reference. LeBron beat me to that one, I think.
No problem. So where are you located right now?
Well, I just left Santa Monica, California. I'm out here in Pasadena, where I'm staying for a few more weeks while we are making first season of the new Kenan Thompson show. The show's called Kenan.
Okay.
That we're shooting at Universal Studios in Burbank.
All right. Well, that kind of leads into my first question for you. Kind of give us a history of your works and who you kind of worked for in Hollywood and out in New York and other places.
Okay. Well, I was in, you know, I had never planned to get into the film business, so to speak. I went to the U, and we were roommates at the U when we were in college back in the 80s.
Right.
And I was studying to be a journalist, and my plan was to become like a serious journalist and work at a place, you know, in D.C. covering, you know, national politics. That was my plan. And that's what I studied, and that's what I set out to do. So one year, I think it was 1986, we were at the National Association of Black Journalists convention, and they screened She's Gotta Have It, Spike Lee's first feature film.
Right.
And I was so impressed with the film, it just kind of shook me up, and I just sat in the audience with another Minneapolis friend of ours, Michelle Norris, who's done big things in journalism. You know, she went around the country with Michelle Obama when Michelle Obama's book came out and was interviewing her. But we were at the convention together, and we just sat in that audience just kind of mesmerized by what we just saw. He was a young African-American storyteller, really. Who, you know, presented his story about this woman named Nola Darling.
Right.
And, you know, he kind of made the audience think, So the lighthearted comedy and went through as, you know, three different boyfriends. But what was really cool about it, what I thought was very, very special about the film, was at the end, he realized what he's really doing is he's examining how women are treated if they have more than one boyfriend, and how men are treated if they have, like, three girls, you know, on the side.
Right.
And there's a big difference, you know, so he was looking at that kind of double standard between men and women. And I just thought the way he did it, it was funny, it was fresh, it was, you know, it was so well done. I just thought, wow, this guy, you know, he's impressive. He's pretty special.
So,
and that likely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you, so how does that, viewing that movie, then gets you onto the road of becoming a film?
Well, I'll tell you, I after that movie, and sitting there in the audience, you know, I just thought, wow, this is something I really want to kind of watch and see what happens. And over the next 2 to 3 years, came out with School Days and then Do the Right Thing. And by then, you know, I was finishing up college and I had to make some decisions about my career. And I, you know, I had gotten some offers to go to work for some different news organizations. And when it came time to make a choice, you know, I told, I had a summer internship with the Associated Press, and I had to decide what I wanted to do it at the end of the internship, where I wanted to be placed with Diddy. And I said, you know, I want to take 2 years and, you know, see if I can make something out of this film thing. And I'm just going to, you know, spend the next 2 years not practicing journalism. Just, you know, get some kind of temporary job and, you know, and see if I can become a filmmaker. And, you know, my goal was pretty much to do what Spike Lee had done, direct and produce movies. And, you know, I felt I didn't really have to reinvent the wheel. So a friend of mine said, look, you know, Spike is getting ready to do his next movie. Why don't you write him a letter at his production office in Brooklyn? I was still in Minneapolis, living in South Minneapolis in a little apartment.
Right.
Had a, you know, temporary job, you know, kind of part-time job at a hotel there with a doorman, valet, limo driver.
Yeah, yeah, I kind of remember that.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I went to my boss at the hotel. I said, hey, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So I said, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. I wrote a letter to Spike at his production company, and I dropped it off. I went down, I remember going down to the airport post office, because I didn't know when the film was starting or anything. So it was just something on my heart to say, Let me get the thing in the mail right away. So I sent the letter off, and the following Tuesday, I get a call from Spike's production company, 40 Acres of the Mill Filmworks in Brooklyn. And I was still in Minneapolis. You know, I talked to the guy who was on the phone. He was a production assistant who had worked on Do the Right Thing. His name was Eric Knight. And the more we talked, the more I tried to find some kind of possibility into how I could, you know, possibly come out there and get on whatever the next film Spike was going to be doing. And as it turned out, Spike was in pre-production, and, you know, and Eric said, well, can you be here? Now, this was on a Tuesday morning, and he said, can you be here on Thursday? I said, you mean like in 2 days?
Wow.
And he said, yeah, yeah. I said, well, you know, and he told me that they filled all the paid production assistant jobs. And a production assistant or a PA is kind of a entry-level job.
Right.
Where you're kind of a gopher and,
yeah,
you know, you're doing a lot of different things. So anyway, I said, well, wait a minute, when does the film start? He said, we start a week, you know, we start next week, the following Monday. I said, really? Wow, I didn't realize it was that soon. Well, I can't be there on Thursday, but I'll tell you what, I can, you know, and what he said was, look, all of the paid positions are full, but if you could come out here and find your own place to stay and everything, would you be interested in working for free on the movie as an unpaid intern? You'll have all the same responsibilities as the production assistants. you just won't get paid anything. And fortunately, I saved up some money. I had some little money in the bank. And so I went to my boss at the hotel and said, well, we can't guarantee you that your job will still be here when you're done. And so, you know, but I got to go for this. I really have to, you know, I have to take this shot.
Yeah.
This is my, it's like in 8 Mile, you get one chance, you know, what do you do? And that was my 8 Mile moment. And so I said, okay, well, yeah, I got to take the risk. And, yeah, I found someone to sublet my apartment. And I just jumped in my car and packed up some clothes and got on the highway and drove to Brooklyn. Now, before I did that, I made a call. I was very blessed. I had stayed for several months in New York 2 years earlier when I had an internship at New York Newsday.
Okay.
And you know, I was very lucky and very blessed because I had a half-sister who lived out there with her husband in Brooklyn, and now they had, like a year later, they had just bought a house in Staten Island. And so I called and I begged and I said, look, you know, I have this opportunity, you know, to help me make my dream come true. I said, okay, let me talk to my husband, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, here's the deal. On the weekend, you have to agree that we'll let you stay here for free, but on the weekends, what you have to do is you have to clean all of the bathrooms, and you have to dust all 3 floors of the house, and you have to vacuum all 3 floors. I said that. I'll do it. I would have done anything probably at that point. Now I got a place to stay.
Right.
And I got my plan. I'm getting on the highway, and I'm driving. I'm gonna head out to New York. And I got there Sunday afternoon. Checked in, dropped myself off at my sister's place. Learned to catch the ferry from Staten Island to Manhattan, and then you take the train from Manhattan to Brooklyn or wherever we're gonna be filming that day. And come first thing 5 a.m. Monday morning, I was standing on the set in Brooklyn Heights, which was the first location that we were going to be shooting for the next 50 days. We were going to be moving all over New York at different locations, but that was the first one.
So,
and we were there for about 3 or 4 days, and that was the movie that became Mo Better Blues.
Okay.
With Denzel Washington.
Right.
And, Wesley Snipes. Cinda Williams, Ali.
So you at the time were just free labor for everybody.
Free labor, and I was assigned. I was assigned to work on the set. So
right.
I was basically a set intern. So a lot of my job was most days you get there at 5 a.m. You get your breakfast because they. What's great about working on a movie like that. They have a caterer that they bring in, so you always get you always have enough to eat.
Right.
They provide a hot breakfast. You can go up and order whatever you want for breakfast. And then same thing. Every 6 hours they have to feed you. So 6 hours later you get lunch. And then if they work another 6 hours, then they're gonna work longer. Then they even serve you a dinner too. So or some pizzas or something like that. At the end of the day.
I don't know if I ever told you this or if you remember. I myself was in a movie, Mighty Ducks 2, in town.
Wait, really?
Yeah. So, I got to put on the
feet. Wasn't Keenan in that, too? Wasn't Keenan Thompson in that?
Yeah, but I never saw him or talked to him or anything. I played the assistant coach for Team Trinidad. No speaking lines, and I had to dance a little on the bench after we scored our one and only goal. I'm talking
really?
To... Yeah. I'm talking to...
I didn't remember Team Trinidad playing.
Yeah, it was very early in Mighty Ducks 2. After they reassembled the team, there was an international tournament that went on, and their first game was against Team Trinidad.
Quack, 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 quack,
duck, duck. I digress. Again, I'm talking to Minnesota's own Van Hayden filmmaker, extraordinaire.
My next guest is Gary Wilson, former head women's track coach at the University of Minnesota, and we talked about what he's doing now and also about relationships and dealing with youth and especially young women here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
And now to introduce today's guest, a former, as in retired, head coach of the women's very successful track program at the University of Minnesota, Mr. Gary Wilson. How you doing, Gary? I'm doing just fine. Just trying to find my way through things now, you know. So how many years did you actually hold the title as head track coach of the women's program at the U?
I was head track from 85 to 2007, and then after that I made sure Matt got my track job, and then I stayed on and was his assistant from 2007 till 2013, and you know, and just coached cross country and then coached the distance runners for him. So
I'm bad at math. How many years was that?
27, I think. 27 or 28.
Okay.
You know? So it was fun.
Right. So I've known, that's what I thought, I've known you close to 30 years. Cause you,
that's exactly right.
Because you knew me when I was, as you always tell me, a snot-nosed punk.
You were a snot-nosed punk. From St. Louis.
Right. So I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing, but you would always.
No, it's a great thing.
Okay. But you would always remind me of that every once in a while.
Yeah.
That,
well,
hey,
I didn't want to get too highfalutin, you know, down there in the equipment room.
Oh, yeah. Like that was going to ever happen. People in that room.
No, that was probably the brightest area in the whole building.
Well, we'll talk about that later, because I got some questions about that too. So,
all right.
Let me ask you, what are you doing now besides retirement?
I'm coaching. I'm back coaching high school at White Bear Lake. I coached the. I volunteer with the cross country boy, and
yeah.
I coached the girls a few years and. But now mostly I'm just working with the boys, so it was a good change, because I had coached boys in I coached men at lacrosse back in 75 to 85, but I hadn't coached boys since then, men since then. So it was a great change, though. I loved it. I love it. It's fun, and I still go over and volunteer at the. You know, with track, it just depends on my life. And Susie's retired; my wife's retired now. So I do some woodworking. I do live edge tables and mess around with that kind of stuff. And there's plenty of work to do around the house, because I, you know, we've got 3 acres, and you know, we travel. We've been since I retired, especially, and then now that Susie's retired, when we can travel again, we've been to. Gosh, I don't know. Well, I've been to like almost 40 countries with recruiting and stuff. But,
wow.
But we started to go, like, Susie's my travel person. She's, you know, she said, well, you know, she said, well, what, let's go to Argentina. Okay, let's go to Brazil. All right. And so we've been to Brazil, Argentina, Panama, you know, all over. And she's always saying, hey, don't you want to be involved with this? I said, no. I said, why? He said, because what if you don't like where we go? I said, listen to me. I traveled with 40 women at a time on a plane.
Right.
I want no responsibility. You just tell me what to go, tell me what to do, and I'll do it. I don't carry a briefcase. I don't carry anything. Camp, nothing. I just walk on the plane, and that's it.
So, but you couldn't just totally walk away from not coaching, though. You had to continue to coach.
Yeah, well, and you know this. You know, it's not the administrators and you know, people that make it fun. The kids are what make it fun and enjoy it. And I when I went back, you know, after I finished up with the GRIAC, 2016. When I went back, I told Patty Percival, it was Patty Walsh at the time, she ran for us in 85 to 87. But I told her, I said, the first parent or the first administrator that crosses me, I'm out of here.
Right.
And I did twice. I did quit twice. and then you got to come back. I said, well, I'm not going to come back and take that crap from anybody. No, it's just stupid.
That sounds like when I was coaching youth hockey, and I basically would tell people, I had a couple of parents come up and accost me, and both times it happened as I blew the whistle to start practice. Not when I was in the hallway before practice, as I blew the whistle to start practice, and I was like, are you crazy? And in both cases, I took my whistle off and handed it to them and said, since you can coach this team better than I can, here you go.
Here you go.
And they were like, well, what do you mean? I don't know anything about hockey. And I was like, exactly. Now get away from me. Get away from me and let me coach this team.
Exactly. No, it's just, and the kids have been good, though. I mean, the kids at White Bear are awesome. It's not a lily white school. It's, diverse and
right.
Great kids, all kinds of socioeconomic levels, and but they're like everybody. They're just kids. They're just like the kids that we dealt with in Minnesota or anyplace else, or the pros or whatever. People are people.
Yeah.
So it's just fun to go and be involved.
I tell people all the time the one thing I miss about not working at Athletic Equipment anymore is the kids. The relationships with the kids and watching them grow. Because you know this as well as I do. There's always another group of 18-year-olds the next year, and another group of 18-year-olds next year that you got to bring along and help help raise.
Yes. Yeah. And more and more of that now with the entitlement and the cell phones and but this as well. If you tell a kid, listen, these are the expectations, and you're gonna have to pull your weight, you're gonna have to do what you can do to help the situation, then fine. But if you think I'm gonna wait on you, be your manager or be whatever, you're dreaming. Kids always rise to the level that you expect them to. Now, so the parents sometimes they miss
right.
that memo.
For
the most part,
if you give the kids the chance, they will at least try to.
Exactly.
Whereas, you and I in that business dealt with a lot of adults who couldn't find their way out of a wet paper bag. But that'll be my only negative comment for the day. From the earlier part of the conversation, I have two questions, and here's the first one: is there a difference? What's the biggest difference in coaching female to male athletes?
It's really, if I was going to write a book on it, it would be a one-page book.
Okay.
Maybe even one paragraph. With men, I don't care how stupid, ugly, foolish, idiotic a guy is,
mm-hmm.
ugly or whatever, they think they're the next coming of Brad Pitt.
Yes.
They just, I'm wonderful and I'm great. And so your job is a male coach to say, listen to me. You aren't that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what do you think then? And I go, I'm just telling you, you're not big. And they don't walk away and go, okay. Now, with women, I don't care if you're the most beautiful, intelligent, attractive, tough person that you could possibly be. Most women will think of 18 reasons why they're not. And so you go, listen to me. You're great. You guys have to understand that. So you have to stand up for yourself. You've got to do this. You got to do this. But you're absolutely as equal as anybody else. Well, stop. And so that's the difference. You spend so much time, and it's not rubbing heads. It's just more like, listen,
you
got to understand that you're important. You're just as important as anybody else on this planet. And you have to see yourself that way. And that's what you do most of the time with coaching women. And once they get it, then they're tough. They know what to do. But
I truly understand that. I mean, let's face it. I was the wardrobe department of the athletic department. And so getting young people dressed and dressed correctly was always a struggle. And it would be a hassle to get a young man dressed and to believe in what he's wearing and whatnot. It was a totally different world to do that with a young lady. To get her comfortable enough, to feel comfortable enough to say, yes, I can go out and perform in this. And that's where that's where most of my day was spent, and especially the early part of the school year of getting them dressed and ready to go.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, But plus, I think, too, you know, I talked to many, many people that say, oh, you coach women. How do you put up with the crying? And I said, you just let them cry.
Right.
You know, but they would come into my office, if you don't, they would come into my office, and they'd have 18 problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, okay, now listen to me. The next time you come in, you have to have two solutions to every problem that you've got. And it's amazing how it cut down on the traffic.
Yes.
I'm not here to solve your problem. I will guide you. I will nurture you. I will help you figure it out. But I'm not going to do it for you. And so they would learn that, you know, I'm not going to wait on you. And so they were really good. And they would, they'd have tough times. And they'd come in, they'd cry, and say, well, here's the Kleenex. And when you're done, then we'll continue. And they would, you know, but you couldn't let it get to you. You just go, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know,
I used to have what a former co-worker of ours and former student manager of ours, Michael Kittle Kettleson, she would call, pull your head out of your you-know-what conversations with young athletes. And in some cases, there would be tears shed after the end of those conversations, but it was like, hey, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Do you need to be doing that? What? How do you fix this?
Yeah. Well, I remember Mallory Van Ness, in fact, we just had a baby a couple of days ago, as a matter of fact. But she ran for me back in the Gabe Anderson era.
Okay.
When she first came, she transferred back from Missouri. And when she first came, I could say hi to her, and she'd start crying.
Oh,
and I said, Cal, listen, stop. Well, I have no idea why she was doing it. But anyway. Finally, I said to her one day, I said, now listen to me. Do you think that when you go into your first job and your boss sits you down and says, tell me about this project you're doing, tell me about how it's going, blah, 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 and you start crying? No, no, no. That's not going to fly. And after about, it took almost a year and a half, but she wrote me after her second job. She's an architect now, and she went in and had to present to a panel of, an architectural design that she had for a building, and she before she walked in, she thought, okay, Wilson says I cannot cry in this meeting, and she didn't, and she got through it, and she, she's fine. But it was like, oh my God! I said, no, Mal, you can't do this. You can do it with me right now, but not with somebody's pain.
I once had an athlete of about three, four years ago who went through being the freshman sensation to having a decent junior and sophomore and junior season, but then somebody came on the, and I'm not going to say which sport, but somebody came on the team and was doing what they used to do better, even though that person still had a very key role on the team, and it bugged her, and it was one of those rare occasions where I was actually on the trip with the team, and somebody kept throwing stuff at me, and I figured it out, and a week or so later, I accosted her in the hallway and said, hey, I know it was you throwing at me, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to make a scene on the bus and get you in trouble and this, that, and the other, but I said, and I know why you're frustrated. And I said, you got to let it go. I said, you're a leader of this team,
And you got to let it go and just continue on the way you're handling things. And she immediately broke down and started crying and told me I was 100% correct.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what you have to do. You have to, you know, you have to treat people like adults and say, listen, no, this is, but that part of it, and you know this, when you saw your freshman coming in at first, or my freshman coming in, after 3 or 4 years, they graduate and you go, holy cow, this is a great kid, and mm-hmm. learned, and that's just part of the process. Like, you know, there's an old adage that hospitals are not for healthy people, and schools and athletic teams are not for ready-made, everything is perfect. You're gonna have ups and downs and ins and outs, and it's called life, you know.
Right.
And they learn. They, you know, most, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but 99% of the people learn. You know, some people just don't ever get it, but you just avoid those people.
And what I explained to a couple of my former supervisors were, when those kids come back, guess who the first person they come back to see?
That's right.
I said, you guys talk about me being hard on them and this, that, and the other, but when they come back and they come in the building, the first person they come back and see is me.
Yep, absolutely.
Because I helped them grow up, and I didn't baby them through their four years here. And,
that's exactly right.
And they've now come to the conclusion the best thing they needed was somebody not to hold their hands, but somebody to show them the way. And there's a difference.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so many people now, and I don't care if it's an administrator, a parent, whatever, they're always trying to protect the kid or the person from, you know, any hardship. And you go, no, you're not preparing this woman or man for the rest of their life. You're sending them out there completely unarmed when it comes to, you know, being able to handle pressures or bad news or whatever it is. No, you're doing a disservice.
Yeah.
I just had a talk with our neighbor. We were talking about her kids and our kids, and they're all about the same age, you know, of our kids that are older, and how we raised them. They said, yeah, we never babied our kids. We expected them to do things and to earn their money and do whatever, and so many times now, parents are, you know, they're giving them everything, and you know, oh, you got to have this and that. No, that's not the way the world works. You're gonna end up with instant failure. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not instant, but you're gonna have failure.
Well, my son on his 25th birthday, it was late, so I'm quite sure he had a drink or two. But still, he texted me and he thanked me for raising me the way I did. And he pointed out the reason why. He said his friends can't figure out how to do anything.
Exactly.
Whereas, exactly. He says the first thing he hears when he gets in a situation is, what would my old man tell me to do? Which is,
exactly.
Sit down and figure it out. and stop looking for somebody to help you fix it.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. I mean, you can get people advice, but at the end of the day, you're the one that's, you know, got to do it. Like, you know, any of us, with anybody that we deal with, is you can... I used to sit kids down in my office, and this was they thought I was a little egotistical, which I wasn't, but I used to have, you probably have seen it, I used to have a big, in fact, it's on my office wall here, of my wife did it for me when I was inducted into the Drake Relays Hall of Fame, and I used to turn to it, and I pointed to it, and I said, you see this? I said, this is the Drake Relays Hall of Fame. I've already made my career. I've already done
it. Yep.
I said, you can do whatever you want to do. I said, you know, I sat a kid down once in the field house, and I said, you see all those banners up there on the wall there where we won Big Ten titles and regional titles and done well nationally? Yeah. Well, you know what? That's them. That, they did that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting here telling me, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I said, no. I said, you're going to make your banner. You're going to, whatever that banner is for you, you're going to do it. But you're not going to do it the way you're doing it right now. You're going to end up, you're just going to... And a high school kid, I said, you're going to end up in jail. I said,
right.
You're not doing the right thing. You can do whatever you want to do, but I'm not going to be the one in prison. You are. Well, I know. No, you don't know.
No. That leads me to my next question, and it'll give you a chance to brag a little bit. You were the architect of one of the most successful Midwest
track programs in the country. How can you let people know how successful the program was while it was under you?
Well, we, you know, I tell this story all the time, and especially with young coaches that I've mentored, you know, over the, around the country, they'll go into a program. In 1985, when I came in here, we went, and I'm giving you the preface on this. We went into the Big Ten meet that first year, fall 1985.
Mm-hmm. I was a student.
We finished the big. Yeah, you were a student, exactly. We finished ninth out of 10 teams at the time. I thought we finished 11th. We were so bad. I said, "This is, you know." And I come from Wisconsin lacrosse. We won 4 national titles. Yeah. Some conference titles, and I went from being what I thought was a really good coach to being like terrible. I just went, "Oh my God!" I said, "This is going to cause me to drink heavily." And then 3 years later, we made nationals, and Eileen Donahue won the Big Ten individual title. And you know, towards the you know, in the 2000s, end of the 90s and 2000s, we ended up with you know, we won 6 Big Ten titles and went to nationals. 12, 13, 14 years in a row and cross country and, you know, we had good teams. We had, you know, great kids and lots of, you know, talented kids, but, you know, and I just, you know, but again, you know, and I'm not bragging. It's just one of those things where if you give kids an opportunity and you have to do things, and you know this,
mm-hmm.
I'm preaching to the choir here, but, You have to decide what your values are and what your rules are for life and for the team, and then you have to follow through. And if we had a kid, the class is a Big Ten title, but and I won't tell you who it was or what. But you know, she got picked up for DWI, and we ended up, you know, we brought her in, and I was the assistant coach at the time. I had recruited her, I wasn't coaching her. I never coached her. She was like, you know, in other groups. But anyway, you know, Matt and I sat down, Glenn, and I said, well, we have no choice here. She's going to be done. Well, yeah, but we're going over the conference meet. I said, and your point is what? I said, no, you broke, not only did you break the team rule, you could have killed somebody, you could have killed yourself. It's just, no. And so we held our ground, and not only did she lose the conference meet, but she didn't go to regionals, and she didn't go to nationals, and she was a senior. She was done.
Right.
And I just, you know, you have to decide, these are the rules that I'm going to run my team by and my life by, and you can hedge the bet all you want and lie to yourself and say, oh, well, you know, this, she just really didn't mean it, or she's the star of the team, which this kid was. No, we're not going to do it that way. And so once you do that, then everything else will fall in place. Now, you're going to have, you know, as you know, we all have bad years. We have, mm-hmm. you know, you just have to get through it. You know, there were times when, you know, we'd have a bad year. We'd have kids hurt. We'd have kids redshirt. We'd have, you know, whatever. And we might finish 7th or 8th in the conference meet, and the next year we'll be back in the top, you know, 1, 2, or 3. So, but that's just part of life. So we had good success, but, you know, and the kids are doing great now. I mean, I remember poor Matt, oh my God, when he took over, we won 3 indoor titles in a row.
Right.
The next year, this must have been 2011, I think, we went to Nebraska, and we had injuries, we had a lot of kids that, you know, graduated. It was just, oh my God. Were there 11 teams? Yeah, there was 11 teams in the Big Ten at that time, because Nebraska had just been at. We went to Nebraska for an indoor meet. Oh my God. We went on the, they had a place for scoring for the teams, 10 teams. We weren't even on that 10 teams. We were 11.
Right.
And he's going, oh my God, I said, I don't know, this wasn't my fault, this must be your fault, you're the coach.
Listening back to some of these good memories, but it also tells me that I needed to work on sound quality, which I did. Well, After this short message on the JB's Low Tech Podcast, we will get back with our last person of the first ever best of the JB's Low Tech Podcast, and he'll be coming to the mic. That's all I'll say. Here next on the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
Year. What season? Baseball and softball season, of course. Are you ready? What about you players out there? Are you ready? Is your equipment ready? What about that glove you've been using? What about that uniform you've been wearing year after year? Well, I tell you what, if it needs to be repaired, bring it to JB's Glove Repair. He'll have you together in no time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair. With over 30 plus years of experience, he'll have you ready by game time. That's JAYBEES Glove Repair.
Again, I want to thank my younger brother, Kevin Blackshear, who's the voiceover talent for the JB'sGloveRepair.com. Yeah, it's taken off and it's doing good. Well, as I promised, the next guest would be coming to the mic, and his name is Kevin Bozeman. He's a national comic and a friend, and we talked about one night that he had and his rebound from the COVID break here on the JB's Low Tech Podcast. How the shows and crowds been this weekend?
You know, it's not the normal Acme packed house, but it's still Acme, so it's good to be on stage, and that's great. It's good to be back performing live. So yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so how has COVID affected your touring and your actor?
I mean, it's affected it majorly. Like, I've probably, since March, I've probably done 10 weeks of shows total, where before COVID, I mean, I've been doing stand-up for 20 years, and before COVID, I had never gone more than 2 weeks off. But now, you know, it's just, I've been performing a lot more online, but that's just not the same. But right. It's just an adjustment you gotta make, man. I tell people this all the time. You either adjust with the times or you don't. But whatever the situation is, you just gotta make the best of it. It's unfortunate for everyone. No good is coming out of this for anyone. You just gotta make the best of the situation. So luckily I got my health, and luckily I can still perform. So
those are the key things. But how is it performing virtually?
You know what? It's actually pretty great. Like, except that, you know, I don't get to leave the house, but it's pretty fun. You know, I do a lot of shows. I do very few public shows. I do a lot of like private shows for businesses and corporations and fundraisers and stuff like that. But yeah, they're fine. They're fine. I don't mind them at all.
Doing those corporate shows, do that affect your act in any way? Do you have to change up some things? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. But it's still cool. Like, you know, I like to push the envelope,
right,
in my act regardless. But, you know, I still play within the rules. And it's more or less language and content that they're concerned about. But, yeah, you got to make some slight variations, but nothing too crazy.
And I want to remind my audience that we're talking to Kevin Bozeman, who's at Acme Comedy Club, or had just finished up a weekend at Acme Comedy Club. You got anything else planned next week, or are you just heading back to Chicago?
No, I'll be in Arizona for a couple of days. I'm going straight from Minneapolis to Arizona.
Okay.
Which is a great... You should always go from Minnesota to Arizona. That should always be... And especially in January, that should always be the route to go home to,
right,
Chicago. You go Minnesota, Arizona, and then Chicago. But then I'll be off for a little while. And then I mean, I'm going back to work gradually, but I don't think I'll ever go back to what I used to, where I was just working every week. I just don't think that'll happen for me. But I would like to get on the road twice a month.
Right.
Yeah. That's ideally when things get back to normal. the new normal, I should say.
Right. Do you think you won't go back to what you know because of the way places are going to book people, or just because you found other avenues to perform?
Well, it's just like I've just gotten so used to being home, and I have a little one at home.
Oh, congratulations.
So he's not that little, but thank you. He's working on being, he's 2.5.
Okay.
So just to be around and watching him grow up, and plus with the combination of being able to do shows online, and I don't think that's going away. I think that's going to be here to stay.
Yeah, because from what I understand, not only are you performing to the smaller than normal group at Acme, but you might also have a virtual spot going on at the same time.
Yeah, so you can definitely live stream the show at Acme, which is great, which is a great feature to have. So I dig that. But even still, it's just some places, like I said before, it's just doing Zoom just for businesses and organizations and stuff. Doing those kind of shows allows me to not have to be on the road as much.
Well, I want to let our audience know, if you expect me to ask to be funny, that's the number one rule you do not do when you're interviewing a comic. You never ask them to be funny, or you never ask them to do their routine.
Yeah, I mean, you have so much of my stuff available online. You can just run those clips. You don't need me to come out run jokes.
Yeah, I mean, why have somebody on to do their act where it should be about getting to know them or reconnecting or doing whatever you're going to do?
Right, you're not asking Steph Curry to come on and shoot free throws. Exactly. Show some respect. Show me some respect.
Exactly. That's that was the analogy I was going to use. You don't ask basketball players when you go down the street to pull up a hoop and start shooting.
Right.
You may ask for an autograph, and I'm quite sure Kevin may not have a problem with signing an autograph, but please don't ask him to be funny or tell jokes. That's, you know, they have a life just like everybody else, and they want to get off to the stage.
Yeah.
So did I have it correct? You are from Chicago?
Yeah. Yeah, born and raised in Chicago.
Okay. And so you went to grade school, high school. Did you attend college?
Grade school, high school, and then I went to college. I went to a junior college in Iowa. Then I went to Wisconsin Whitewater after that.
And what were your plans in college? What were you planning to do?
I didn't. Man, I was running around with it like a chicken with my head cut off. There's so many things. I was always meant to do stand-up, and I just didn't know it, but, I mean, I just did all sorts of things, just filling a void, and it seems like a blur. You know, I sold insurance, I worked in group homes, I did all sorts of things, just hustling, just collecting, trying to get paychecks, but it wasn't until I started doing stand-up that I was just like, okay, there it is. There's your path.
And so, how did you know, or when did you know, that was what was meant to be for you?
I would say, so, I always thought that I could be funny, and me and my buddies, we would watch Def Comedy Jam back in the day, and I was like, I could do that, and then I just wanted to see if I could do it, because I always could go into a room and get laughs, and I was just like, I just want to go and see if I could do it, and then once I did it, I wanted to get better at it. I wanted to get good at it. And once I started putting in the work, that's when I was just like, okay. So it was a gradual thing, but it was always probably calling at me. I was just late to answer the call.
Is there somebody in your family that was funny and you kind of picked up of it from them?
No, you know what? I come from a big family. My family, they're all pretty funny, but they're not as funny as me. They need to bow down when I walk into the room when it comes to funny. But they're all funny in their own right. But none of them, I wasn't really aspired to do stand-up from anyone. I'm telling you, it was just, it was just in me. It was just in my fiber. It was just a matter of bringing it out.
So you mentioned Def Comedy Jam. Were there any comedians on there that kind of stoked the fires a little bit for you?
Oh, it's just the whole show. The whole format of it was just exhilarating. But there was, you know, there were some great comics on there. But just the show itself was just really just was fun to watch, and it was just a fun atmosphere at the time. It was so it's such a '90s feel to it. When you go back and watch old episodes of it, it's just so the '90s, just the way they dressed and the way it's shot. But yeah. That's fun. Yeah. Martin Lawrence on there obviously was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember those shows, and they just had the 25th anniversary about a year or two ago.
Yeah.
It was odd because I was expecting more performances, and it was more built on looking back at things. But
it's kind of hard to have performances where you have a bunch of people, stand-up comics, going up and performing with a bunch of stand-up comics in the audience.
And that would be because you would feel uncomfortable, or you think they...
No, just comics. A lot of times comics that see, you know, comics aren't necessarily going to go to a comedy show and laugh. They'll see something that's funny and see how it's working and can see what you're doing. More than just sitting back and appreciating the show. You never want, as a comic, you never want to perform in front of a bunch of comics. It's just, yeah. But yeah, so I was actually surprised at how many performances they did have, which were great. So
I want to thank you for listening to the first ever Best of JB's Low Tech Podcast, sponsored by Bryshaw and Bryant, and also JB'sGloveRepair.com. I want to thank today's guests, Van Hayden, filmmaker Gary Wilson, former women's track coach and world traveler, and Kevin Bozeman, national comic. You can hear more things or hear their full episodes at podbean.com and look up for JB's Low Tech Podcasts. And you can go back and listen to all my podcasts. Also, you can go on Facebook, and there is a JB's Low Tech Podcast page on Facebook. And also look out for postings on Twitter. Again, thank you for listening to JB's Low Tech Podcast. And also, before I part company, I want to thank Tony Lee for creating yet another show opening and closing for the JB's Low Tech Podcast.
I want to talk to show some love for the hilarious Mr. JB.
The Black Avenger.
Godfrey Cambridge is Gravedigger Jones. Raymond St. Jock is Coffinhead Johnson.
Look out for a brother, man.
What you gonna play now?
Is the girl crazy?
That's
the beast. I sure am hungry.
Baby, check, baby, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2.
Black is black.
And you're black.
Was as big as Muhammad Ali.
Black is beautiful.
Right on.
I'm black, y'all, and I'm black, y'all, and I'm blickety black, blacker than black, black. I'm blacker than black, yo, because I'm black.